Accession number 26561, reel 4.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 4. We've come to the point where you become an instructor, still at
yes.
number 10.
Yes.
At Abingdon.
Yes.
And you're there from May until July as an instructor, with some operational flights which will become apparent
at the end,
as well.
Yes.
Now, what rank were you as an instructor?
I was still a sergeant. Flight sergeant by then.
And was it that
way? Came through. I started as sergeant and came through.
And that's when you got that promotion to flight sergeant while you were there. And
flight sergeant.
Flight sergeant, yes. What exactly were your duties then as instructor? Take us through what were you doing?
Yes, I would take the pupil up and sit alongside him and guide him on how to operate and what to listen for. And I used to carry a ruler so that he wouldn't touch the tuning controls and just tap him on the knuckles because the signal was there. And if he twisted the knob, you know, because he couldn't hear it, I said, well, no, it'll be there if you haven't altered the tuning. that's the main thing.
You knew so much about it. How did you find the level of knowledge or the ability of the wireless people you training?
Some of them were very good key bashers, but they didn't know much about why or when. Their background engineering in the wireless technology was very, very low.
And that presented a problem with the part of the job that was repairing wirelesses.
Oh, yeah, the emergency rebuild of the set if it blew up, you know. But we'd do that on the ground, and we'd also have cubicles were called Harlem. What's the atomic research people? Harland, yes, was for the Wellington's OTU. That was a sort of parent OTU to us, but they did Wellington's, and the other one did Whitley's, and they developed a very good thing on rocker feet. It had sort of bent structures underneath, so it was rocked, and there was a dreadful aircraft engine noise going on in all the cubicles, which were set up like the inside of the aircraft, and they were able to operate on the ground without burning up airspace.
And did you use that as well?
Yes.
You shared it with them, or did you build your own?
No, the design was theirs, and I believe we built them ourselves at Abingdon.
And how realistic was that, do you reckon?
Well, I think it was good. It was better than nothing, and better than a desk in a classroom, because it gave the environmental noise that they would have in an aircraft, and they'd be thrown about because the instructor would come push this seesaw device, and they'd be all over the place whilst they were operating.
And would you actually have them doing the emergency wireless repair in this thing as well? That's really cruel.
Well, yes, because that's what would happen for real. And teach them to draw out the circuitry or keep a copy in the logbook.
Now, what about, we haven't actually discussed the aircraft too much, it's the Anson and the two Whitleys. Let's take the Anson first. You've mentioned the problem with the Anson.
Yes.
What did you think of the Anson as an aircraft? I mean, to fly in and as an aircraft.
Oh, very good. That was the one that was used for patrolling late at the end of my instructor period. I only had, there was just two of us. There was a wing commander, there was a flight sergeant, Freddie Steele, who had already done a tour of ops, which was most unusual in those days. You know, to have done 30 ops by this time, by June, July. and he and I manned this bombed up Anson and patrolled up and down the east coast of England from Marham through to Linton on Ouse.
And what were you looking for?
Invasion barges on the coast. And we just flogged up and down there. And it was very funny. I was everything. I was the gunner, bomber, wireless operator, navigator and that.
But just two of you?
Yes.
In an Anson?
Yeah, because we wanted to get a maximum number of small-sized bombs in this. And it was all daylight stuff. And we flogged up and down. At that time, what were the flights to the Isle of Man and back for training, going over the Snowdon and various hills and so on, mountains.
Tell me about these invasion, anti-invasion patrols a bit more. So how did the two of you manage? I mean, you managed all right. Just
yeah.
Because there's normally five, isn't there, in Anson?
Not what?
There's normally five in an Anson, isn't there?
No, three.
Oh, right, I've got it wrong there. Right, okay.
Yeah.
So you were able to cope reasonably well?
Oh, yes, and I mean, dear Freddie Steele, he would be, it was no autopilot in that aircraft, and I'd be busy getting a fix to find out exactly where we were, and I get a tap on the shoulder, because I was queuing up with the DF station to get some navigational fixes. And he'd tap me on the shoulder and go back to the tin funnel with the rubber tubing, have a wee, and step over the main beam. And the aircraft, as he walked back, the aircraft so I used to dash out of my seat, which was behind his, on a plotting thing, and grab the controls. We learned to land aircraft, by the way.
When?
We didn't do any takeoffs because we assumed that there was a good pilot on board when you took off. But in the event of him being shot, we had the ability or the training to land the two types of aircraft.
So basically emergency landing training?
Yes.
What were you taught to do? I mean, how were you meant to do? I mean,
oh, we didn't. We only did about two or three of them, but they're exciting, yeah.
And you managed, when you did it okay.
Yeah.
Now, we got into that, these patrols. Did anything ever happen on them?
No, we just flogged up and down, and they didn't come as we expected.
We
had done some, we did two trips to the, across the channel to bomb the barges in there, but not, that was in the, in a Whitley.
Well, before we go into that, I'll cover them separately. Let's talk about the Anson. What was it like then as an aircraft? You said you liked it. Why did you like it? What was good about it? Because not everybody likes the Anson.
Well, I don't know. It depends. You just accept it. You know, that's the aircraft you're given, and you've got to like it, otherwise you won't fly it.
What was it like? I mean, can you sort of give us an idea of what it was like to be
in? Yes, it was a canvas-covered tubing for the fuselage. And it had one gun, which was elastic-driven, bungee rubber drink to balance it, you know, a Vickers K gun. I called it a K, didn't I? Yes, it was a K shape, Lewis gun. And a number of pans to hand for ammunition, and one single forward-firing Browning.
Would the pilot control that?
He'd control that, yes.
And what was it? What was the environment like in? You know, I mean, the noise, the heat, the rest of it.
What
was it like in the Anson?
Yeah, well, of course, fortunately, it was this sort of weather, you know, and so.
Sunny.
Yeah. But I think if we'd been attacked by a Messerschmitt, we couldn't have competed with it.
So they weren't defensible. Were they agile in the air? I mean, I know they're a big aircraft, but I mean.
Yes, I think so, yes. All right, straight and level.
And what was the noise like? inside?
Noisy, yes, too. I've forgotten the name of the engine. Bristol's, I think. Bristol engines.
Now, tell me about the bombing raid. These are. Do you actually drop bombs on the barges, or did it not?
In the Whittler, that was the idea, yes.
Now, tell me about those. Was that with Freddie again? Freddie
yes,
Steele?
Yes, just the two of us, yes.
And what was the Whitney? Well, tell me what the raids were like. Which port were you after?
The one in Holland was the one we went to twice.
Rotterdam or?
I can't remember. It was Dutch coast.
And what do you remember of those?
A lot of flak came up. You know, they guarded those areas pretty well, but we just dropped the bombs on the harbour sightings and got the hell out of it, back again, yes.
Were you nervous?
Yes and no. I don't know. We didn't think that. We all knew that that's the 55,000 that were killed, and another additional 10,000 were shot down, became prisoners of war.
This is bomber commander's casualties in this.
Yes,
war.
Yeah. It's enormous. This is my commercial when I give a lecture. I talk about all those young men. Every one of them was a volunteer. Everyone knew that six ops was the average in those days. I called it, later on I called it, kamikaze on hire purchase.
We will be dealing with, I mean, you know...
Yeah,
it's
later,
theme,
yeah.
It's a theme you can probably return to whenever it strikes you. Now, what was the Whitley like to fly as compared to the Anson Orwell?
Yes, much different. Faster, and it had much better defence, of course.
In what way?
That's a brass model of it. Well, in so much as you were shot out from the tail, you had four guns to defend it in the rear.
And a bigger crew, wouldn't it be, normally?
Yes, crew of five, six.
And
five
was
or six.
Only two of you during this rotter.
No, the full complement.
There's a full crew on that?
Full crew on that, yes.
So?
I was just wireless operating, so I wasn't navigating, that's why I didn't know the name of the...
And it all round a better aircraft as far as you were concerned?
Oh, gosh, yes, chalk and cheese. It was the most, the Whitley was the most, we had more Whitleys than any other kind. It was the only ones that could get over the Alps, for example. It had a marvellous range, and I'll come to the Polish trip later on.
It's not such a well-known aircraft now,
no,
is it?
No, it was then.
Well, it seems to have faded from people's collective memory, as opposed to the Lancaster and the Wellington.
Well, because most of them were killed.
You mean people who flew the Whitley were in the war longer, and therefore had more chance of being killed?
Yes.
Do you think it was? You obviously think it was up to the job, though. I mean, you don't have basic objections.
No,
I stepped
out of three write-off crashes, complete write-offs. And live to tell the tale.
Now, so, anything else? What's next in your time as instructor? Did you say one of your crashes
I was in Whitley 3.
This is when you're actually instructing?
Yeah, I was instructing the wireless operator.
Tell us the background to the crash. What happened?
Well, all of a sudden there was a hell of a grunching noises and... And he'd ripped the belly off the thing. He'd landed with his undercart up. That wasn't too bad a crash, but subsequent ones were.
Did you get thrown about a lot?
And then just dreadful juddering, you know. And a shorter stop than usual.
But the machine held together. It didn't break.
Oh yes,
up,
didn't
it? And didn't catch fire.
The Whitley never caught fire. They had a wonderful system in them. They had a thing.
That's really interesting because aircraft.
Yeah.
How did it all work?
Well, in the Whitley, there was a thing called a Gravener switch, which is a sort of saucer with a pendulum sort of jammed in it. And if it hit any, if the aircraft hit anything, that pendulum swung out of the little cup and all the fire extinguishing stuff came on. I've stepped out of three Whittlers and none of them caught fire. I'll tell you when I shot down what happened then.
And that's obviously a very effective system. Was that system used?
And there's petrol. There's petrol. I don't know. I didn't work on other aircraft.
But as far as you were concerned, this was a really effective and it worked every time.
Yeah.
What were the was it sprinklers or sprays? Were they in the whole aircraft?
No, they were gas. They were gas nozzles, little copper tubes, and in all the salient positions.
Which would be
near fuel tanks and so on. The tanks were self-sealing. I'll tell you when we shot down what happened there.
And
icing.
What would it spray?
It would.
Was it water?
Gas.
What type of gas? So just a gas.
Carbon tetrachloride gas. You know, the gas from a vaporization of carbon tetrachloride. Very good.
And you were going on to say other fire. They also had self-sealing tanks. What about the self-sealing tanks? I mean, did you understand how they worked? I mean, people, you know.
Oh yes, they had a sort of soft sponge rubber. As you know, if you hold it close to the surface, you can drop a match onto a bucket of petrol, and it won't catch on fire. But hold it higher, and you've got a gas. It's the gas that catches on fire, not the liquid.
And so the self-sealing prevented.
We've fired bullets into it.
We'll perhaps come back. What are the safety precautions? Because this is really interesting about the. Whitney was so good about not catching fire.
Yes.
Anything else about it?
Yes, it had very good leading edges on the main wing, which were rubber bands which de-iced when you went through an icy cloud or something like that. The ice forming, of course, could do considerable damage to the flight of the aircraft, and it had these rubber skirting about that big, about 10 inches across, and it was rubber that pulsed and shed the ice when it settled on the rubber.
So all round, what was it like for the crew? A crew accommodation in there? So
there was no heating. No heating. It was. And I think the pilot's supposed to have had a little bit of something off an engine somewhere, but not really. And the
was it cold then?
Very cold in the winter. Yes, bitterly cold. And
so what would you wear in the early days?
Well, the first op I did. I got all dressed up in.
Now, which op is this? Is this when you went to the Dutch coast?
No, the one that I really.
Shall we save this then on proper ops? I've led you astray there. So, we've talked a bit about the Whitley. Anything else about your time really? Just this 2 or 3 months when you're an instructor. Any other stories of what was happening or going on?
Yes. We just got a stream of people coming through there. Some of them got slung off because they weren't good enough, but not many. I'm surprised today they would have slung them off a lot earlier, but they were desperate for air crews, and their training was very pathetic, to say the least. When a pilot came along and he'd only done 14 hours on a little biplane, was very poor.
So you don't feel it was adequate?
Oh, no. But what else could they do? You know, they left it too late.
Now, what's the next stage then? Come to leave? Or is there anything else before you?
Yes, I was doing 200-hour flying hours a month when I was an instructor there. That's a hell of a lot of flying. I practically lived in the air. And if I wasn't, I'd be in the hangar on these Howell boxes. And I worked very hard over that time. Say 200 hours is what a Cranwell cadet would take 3 years to do. And anyway, I came back from this. I'd been to the Isle of Man and back,
Now, what was this?
Twice that day.
So this is just on flights?
This is just instructional flights for operational training flights, yes. And I came back and they said, oh, Bernard, Flight Sergeant Bernard, you're posted. I said, oh, tell me in the morning. And I was very tired by this. This is about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, you're posted. I said, oh, well, tell me in the morning. No, he said, you've got to go right away. And so I had two kit bags, and I put all my ordinary kit in one and my flying kit in the other, and hopped on the back of a lorry, and they took me down to the station with the tickets and everything, and I was posted to the special duties unit.
Now, what is this 419?
419, yes.
And the special duties division or special duties squadron?
It's a flight.
It's just 419. That's 419 flight is the name.
They altered it later on after I shot down to 1419 because it was a 419 Canadian squadron.
Now, where was 419 flight based?
To start with, on the fighter station at Northfield.
What were your first impressions on arriving? Because
this is
your first operational posting, really, isn't it? And this is July, by the way.
Yes,
1940.
Yes. Well, it's taken best part of all of a day getting through, and London was being bombed at the time, and we were shunted in and out of sidings, and eventually a series of train changes. I was very tired by this time. I arrived at Northfield, and I was very tired because I'd been flying all the previous night, and I went around and there was nobody in the sergeant's mess, and I thought, gosh, I've got to get my head down somewhere. And so I went in, and all these sergeant's bunks were empty. Not a soul was in them, so I thought, well, the one with the least furnishing in it, I'll get my head down. If he comes in, I'll say, sorry, I'm tired. And I did that, and I went into breakfast next morning, and somebody said to me, where did you sleep last night? I said, oh, in the sergeant's sleeping quarters. He said, well, there's an unexploded bomb in there, that's why there's no... And then they wanted to know. Nobody knew where 419 was, and not even the adjutant or the station commander knew. And it was so secret that it was the other side of the airfield, and had a large size hut, which the crew, just a crew room really, and there was an office at the end. And that
was that secret that even on that
station commanders were not allowed to know what we did. No, they didn't. They never knew what we did.
So no, and you were presumably not allowed to talk about it.
No, gosh, no. We how did it go now? It was just that so secret. We were given a top secret secrecy thing to sign that we. Nothing for 30 years after the war, sort of thing. And that's when we started.
What was your reception? You went over to this hut, I presume.
Eventually somebody said, well, there's a funny, there's a Lysander over there, but you're not a Lysander man. And R. Whitley hadn't arrived from the factory at this time. And Churchill had thought up this special fight to put spies into France to start with.
Now, when did they tell you, what was your reception, when did you get to know this? Because you're still at the moment, there's just a hut over there, and you wander across, you go across.
Yeah.
What happened when you got there? How did they take you into the unit and explain what was going on?
Well, I eventually found, and I met up with Di Davis, who'd gone a day before me. He hadn't been on night flying, so they'd posted him in early. He said, oh, we're over at the hut, the other side of the airfield. The Lysander there, and Whitley should have arrived last week, and it's not here yet, but it'll be here. And when we went over there, and there was no radio in it, no guns.
Well, the Whitley.
The Whitley came straight from the factory, all wrapped in tissue paper everywhere. We tore all that lot out, and there was no radio, so we went. Being a fighter station, of course, they didn't have bomber radios. They happened to have a bomber receiver, a 1082, in the signal section, so we commandeered that and put that into the Whitley. And the guns, of course, were the same as those in the Spitfire, and I got four of those and loaded them in and harmonised them all very quickly. And we were off, I think we had 2 days to get all this done.
Now, who briefed you as to what the role of the unit was? And if you could incorporate into that, telling us what the role of the unit
well,
was.
Well, they didn't for a while. The CO, I've forgotten his name now, the first one was a flight lieutenant. Names. I'll get it for you later in the book. There was only two. There was a flying officer and a flight lieutenant running this. And he'd come off fighter aircraft, but he flew Lysanders. And the Whitley arrived, and we got another pilot, Jackie O'Toole, who had been a Whitley man. And the brand new Whitley arrived, as I said.
You fitted it out?
We fitted that, but no transmitter. And we said, well, this is it, you know. And the CEO had lent me his car to go and get guns and so on, which I pinched out of the armoury, you know.
But you still didn't know what you were doing?
Still didn't know what we were really up to, no.